Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. We'll hear from the creators of a mobile application that seeks to raise awareness of the symptoms of maternal and neonatal conditions on black and brown skin.
This app seeks to ensure that there's proper education both for the healthcare providers and for the patients. And also, I think the most important part is to eliminate bias in healthcare through accurate information of these conditions. We only see cyanosis represented on white skin, and this shows a bit of bluish purple coloration. But on black skin, you do not see the purple and bluish coloration.
And in Uganda, we'll hear from the minister behind a new bill that aims to restore respect for the elderly. It's Friday, October 11th. First, we go to Eritrea. The president of Eritrea, President Isaias Afwerki, has been hosting the leaders of Egypt and Somalia in his capital, Asmara, this week. The meeting heightened political tension in the region. That's because many see this meeting as a concern for Ethiopia, which hasn't been invited due to strained relations with all the three countries. There are two key issues at the heart of all this. The first is that Ethiopia is building a massive dam on the Blue Nile in the north of the country, and Egypt has long been concerned that the dam will have a massive impact on its water supply. The second is that Ethiopia recently signed a deal with Somaliland to build a port and a naval base on the Red Sea. The problem is that Somaliland is a breakaway region of Somalia, and Mogadishu says the deal is illegal and considers it an act of aggression. By the way, we've been covering both these stories for a while here on Focus on Africa. So if you want to know more, just scroll back through the podcast feed and you'll find episodes on both. Now, the tensions have even reached a point where some analysts are asking whether there might be a full-scale conflict as a result of what's going on. So let's dig a bit more into that meeting between Egypt, Somalia, and Eritrea. I've been speaking to regional expert Dr. Hassan Kanenje, director of the Horn International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Of course, Ethiopia is not part of this summit because it's an axis against Addis Ababa, let's face it. Both capitals are not exactly big fans of Addis Ababa right now, and I think it's an attempt to bring the heads together in trying to increase pressure against Addis Ababa. To the extent that that is happening at the doorstep of Addis Ababa, I think is something that is further going to fuel the tension that we are seeing, because it's going to harden negotiating positions if any negotiations were to take place.
And specifically looking then at Eritrea and Somalia, they have grown quite close at the moment. What do you think is the basis of this alliance, or is it just a case of my enemy's enemy is a friend?
It's an alliance of convenience. It just happens that both capitals are not big fans of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government right now. And so because they having a common enemy, it's convenient for them to work together. Not to mention, Eritrea has been involved in the past in actually training some of the Somali forces. And so they have a long history, you know, going back. Somalia is having a conflict with Ethiopia over the memorandum of understanding was signed between Addis Ababa and Somaliland, or Hargeisa, which is kind of a breakaway region of Somalia, and Somalia does not recognize it. So because Somalia itself is looking for allies in its struggle, you know, against Addis Ababa over the MOU, it's very convenient that Eritrea, that understands Ethiopia very well, it's brought into the fold of Mogadishu.
So looking specifically then at Somalia, Ethiopia, Eritrea as well, I mean, are we looking at a situation where we are looking at tensions that could flare up at any moment between any of these countries or just even among all of them?
You know, when you're having a situation of relative chaos that are not properly managed, anything can happen. And so you cannot rule out potential conflagration between Somali forces and Ethiopian forces in the near future, considering that Somalia has made it abundantly clear that they do not want Ethiopia to be part of the security architecture in Somalia as long as it maintains its memorandum of understanding in the use of the port in Hargeisa with Somaliland. With regard to, for instance, Eritrea, which has relatively been a country that has been heavily sanctioned in the region, there was hope when there was a rapprochement between Asmara and Addis Ababa, but that quickly faded with the peace that was made between TPLF and Addis Ababa, in which I think Asmara thought they were left out. And so, in the meantime, they've actually been kind of playing a spoiler role in Addis Ababa, and they're not exactly the friendliest terms. And so you will not be surprised if, for instance, they may support non-state actors in conducting some activities inside Addis Ababa again, which again may then push Ethiopia perhaps to take some kind of action against Eritrea, you know, reminiscent of the war that they fought between 1998 and 2000.
Help us understand then just those two parties that you've just mentioned, Eritrea and Ethiopia, because they have had a very long and tricky relationship. They fought a very long war until they got independence in the early 90s. So what's the beef between them and why does the relationship look so delicate? Because at some point we thought they were friends, but now it turns out they are not.
When Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power, he seemed to be very keen to reestablish relations with Asmara, not the least because also it may allow, you know, Addis Ababa to access the sea. But I think after the conflict broke out, which they by and large were fighting along the same side when our
allies...
And this is the conflict in Tigray,
is it?
Yes, the conflict in Tigray. The peace that was arrived at appeared not to include in or to factor in the interests of Asmara. And so I think Asmara saw it as a betrayal of making peace with the kind of party that Asmara considered to be enemy, which is the TPLF. And so that, I think, destroyed the kind of relationship and the rapprochement that had been built and the kind of engagement that has been going on, you know, for several years, you know, prior to that. And so you expect that unless something, again, there's a move for a wider talks to prevent that or to bring back a new rapprochement with Asmara, the tensions are likely to continue, and you're likely to see perhaps a little bit more closer relationship between Mogadishu and Asmara, as well as Mogadishu and other capitals that may be perceived to be enemies of Addis Ababa.
There are also some international dimensions to this, because these countries do have alliances in Turkey or the UAE or Kenya. Talk to us about that.
The international dimensions, yes. Turkey, for instance, is the biggest soft power in the Horn of Africa, and they have invested extensively and heavily in Somalia. But Turkey is also a friend in many aspects to Addis Ababa, as well as other countries in the Horn. And I think that explains why I think Turkey has been trying to make some efforts towards creating some kind of negotiations between the parties in Mogadishu as well as in Addis Ababa. But the Horn of Africa being and theater for global geopolitics, of course, you expect that other actors are very involved and interested. So it's not just, for instance, the Turks and the Egyptians who are in the region. You know, the Gulf countries, they're investing heavily, not just in ports, but also in security and maritime aspects. The big powers and the emerging powers are also extremely present, as illustrated by about 14 military bases just in Djibouti alone. So that tells you the vitality and the critical importance because of strategic location of the region, as well as it serving as a gateway to the greater east Horn of Africa.
Tell me if you see how this plays out. Are we looking at a situation where a war is imminent, or it's not going to get as far as that?
A war is probable, but it's not likely. If you're going to have a framework or an architecture that is going to allow more participation by other countries that may not require, for instance, robust Egyptian presence, then that is going perhaps to reduce some of those tensions. But if, for instance, Egyptians are going to be involved in ways that is going to perceived to be hurting the interests of Ethiopia, there's a likelihood that you may start seeing challenges inside Somalia as well as challenges within the region. And so I think what happens in the next 2 or 3 months is going to be critical in determining the general direction of the country when it comes to matters of peace, security, as well as fighting extremism and terrorism within the Horn of Africa region.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's Hassan Kanenje from the Horn International Institute for Strategic Studies. A student midwife in the UK has created an app to help detect symptoms of illnesses on people who have black and brown skin. 23-year-old Ruby Jackson said she was inspired to create the app after visiting a neonatal intensive care unit during a placement in Ghana. It was after she noticed that there was a general lack of understanding about how some conditions present in people or babies who are not white. I've been chatting with Ruby about how and why this idea came about.
Actually came as an idea that I wanted to do for my dissertation, but the actual one of the ideas where it kind of originated was following a trip to Ghana. So during my trip, I went on international placement there, and then we went up to the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit, and they were showing us a baby who had jaundice, and they were kind of saying, look at the palms, look at the soles, this baby has jaundice, and it was quite unwell with jaundice. And I sort of realised that it was my first time actually seeing how jaundice presented on a baby with black skin. And while this was partly to do with the demographic of people I've looked after, it was also a massive issue of there not being enough representation within, you know, our education of how different conditions present on black and brown skin.
Ruby, how did you end up in Ghana?
So we had the opportunity to go actually in our second year for international placement. So I went with an organisation called Work the World, and I was really keen to go to Ghana. I'd actually spoken to a lot of the Ghanaian nurses that worked at the trust I work at. Yeah, I was really excited to go, and it was an amazing time. I learned so much, and yeah, it was really eye-opening. So yeah, it was part of my elective placement in year two.
So you're in Ghana, and you know, patients are being presented with symptoms in a way that you're not seen before in terms of the condition, jaundice, and how it manifests itself in different people. At what point do you think that you need to create an app about this?
Obviously, technology is kind of moving forwards now. A lot of the information that we signpost women and families to is digital leaflets and flyers. And I thought this would be a great kind of opportunity to have a platform that's, you know, accessible via technology on our phones. It could be used by clinicians on iPads. It could be used by students in universities during presentations. And also it's accessible to the families that we look after so that they can access education that's inclusive and representative.
And who do you hope will use this app the most?
So my main absolute main priority and objective is to improve outcomes and experiences for black and brown birthing people and families in our services. So I hope in terms of that side, so women and families, they'll use the app, they can refer to it if they have any concerns about any signs or symptoms, and then hopefully they can escalate any concerns. And then in terms of the clinicians, so midwives, health visitors, nurses, they can learn more about how conditions may manifest themselves on black or brown skin. And then also, as I said, yeah, students as well.
Yeah. So you've said that at university you are taught to look for yellow skin when somebody has jaundice, for example, as one of the symptoms that they may have. Can't that be seen on black or brown skin?
So, yeah, it can be seen depending on skin tone as well. Don't get me wrong. And like I said, when I went to Ghana, they said, you know, look at the palms and the soles of the hands. But it's just different to see. And we weren't taught about how it may present more clearly on different parts of the body.
So this app then, how does it work? Talk us through that.
Well, on opening the app, you can access information about the baby or the mother, and it will take you to a range of different conditions. And the app also highlights conditions that disproportionately affect black and Asian mothers as well and babies, so to educate the users around that. And it also in-app signposts people to really useful resources.
And have you had it tested yet? And if so, what's the feedback?
Yeah, so it hasn't been tested yet. It's just going through all of the kind of regulatory processes, and then hopefully it will be trialled within some London-based trusts.
So you do work in those wards. What, in your view, is the reason why black women in the UK are more likely to die during pregnancy? Because that is what statistics and research tells us.
So, yeah, I feel like that is a very, very broad question. And I mean, there's, you know, the research clear, there's a whole umbrella of factors. So I couldn't really say, like, I couldn't say one thing, but I mean, from my aspect of where I'm trying to tackle an issue is the kind of aiding detection and diagnosis, and also in terms of experiences, making Black and brown women and families feel more seen and heard within our services and empowering them to access care when they need it.
I'm wondering, is there an aspect that there's a lack of being able to detect symptoms earlier in Black communities or people of Black and brown skin?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't give you a kind of, you know, definitive answer. From one of the kind of ways I see it is that, and this is across wider medicine, there's a massive lack of representation and inclusion. And even from the clinical terminology that we use, for example, it's in a lot of guidelines, it will say a well baby, a well normal baby at birth should be pink. A baby that has darker skin will not be pink. And I think these are very, we have a lot of very westernized practices. And I think that is to do with a massive lack of inclusion and representation, and that manifests itself into teaching. So therefore, clinician knowledge can be poor, and then signs and symptoms of conditions are picked up much later down the line when the condition has already worsened. So I do think that could definitely have a role to play in the poor outcomes.
Ruby Jackson. I've also been speaking to third-year medical student and designer of the app, Chidiebere Ibe, in Nigeria.
One of the issues in healthcare, you know, we're in health space, and we understand that diagnosis has become a problem, most likely because there's lack of resources, there's lack of adequate training of medical students or medical doctors to be able to diagnose skin conditions, understand that certain conditions can affect certain population. So this app seeks to ensure that there's proper education, both for the healthcare providers and for the patients. And also, I think the most important part is to eliminate bias in healthcare through accurate information of these conditions.
So tell me how you then go about diagnosing illness in children who are darker skin.
I think it's relative to the particular condition. Let's use a case study of cyanosis. It shows a bluish purple discoloration on the skin. In most textbooks or in most medical literature, we only see cyanosis represented on white skin. And this shows a bit of bluish purple coloration. But on Black skin, you do not see the purple and bluish coloration. Rather, you see a dark or a gray and white presentation, right? And because of this, people misdiagnose or do not understand what cyanosis present like on Black skin. And most importantly, cases where it's difficult to identify nail clubbing on the fingernails of babies or children. So this is like one of the case studies where it was difficult to really identify those conditions on Black skin. And also another case study I would like to mention is, I think for jaundice, it's about maybe an increased bilirubin levels in the blood where the skin looks yellowish, for example. On a white skin, it's easy to identify the yellow coloration, but on the Black skin, it can be somewhat difficult to identify those coloration. So this application just tends to give you a privilege to understand the difference in presentation and helping physicians diagnose properly or understand certain conditions relative to Black and brown patients.
Have you then, as a medical student, thought it odd that your medical notes were about white children?
I think this has really been the foundation to my work, because as a medical illustrator working with a lot of organizations and as a student also, last year we took a course in pathology. We studied a lot of skin conditions, and it was hard to realize that all the skin conditions we actually learned in school was all skin conditions on white people. And then I asked myself a question, how can this be represented on Black people, which our population is predominantly Black people? You know, so I've always thought about it. And this has also been the motif of my work, to see how to improve access to these resources and access to this information. Medical students to ask, what does heat rash look like on a Black skin? And it was hard to realize that most of them said it looked reddish on a Black skin. And that is because all our resources, all our medical textbooks only show heat rash on white people. And so this has been a concern for me, even as a medical student, and I also raised those questions. And what I would say also is because of there's not been a conscious effort in the African population to improve adequate resources to education. So I think in recent times, a lot of authors have been trying to incorporate diverse artworks or diverse images in their textbooks or in their medical handbook.
P. picking up on your example there, how does heat rash look like on black skin?
On the white skin, you'd see a bit of redness, but on black skin, the redness are not visible. You only see little skin patches, you know, like it looks a bit of gray color. I mean, the clear difference is that there's absence of redness on the black skin and there's presence of redness on the white skin. So those are like distinctive differences there.
What does that look like, the fact that you're not able to diagnose properly?
Well, I think a decrease in health outcome, because we've had a lot of cases where doctors, not just in Africa, but in the Western world, in the United States, in the United Kingdom, where they literally misdiagnosed patients in children, women, and the rest, because the doctor didn't know what this looked like on black people. It has been a real-time concern because outcomes are going to be decreased. Patients will feel not seen and not heard. And also, not just about children now, because you would say children might not have the ability to speak for themselves. But then, in terms of maternal health, right, it decreases the level of trust you have between the healthcare receiver and the healthcare provider. Overall, generally, it just affects healthcare outcome.
So you've been part of the design for this application. What will the end result look like and how will it work on a day-to-day practical terms?
I'm excited to see how this app is going to be used in the healthcare and how it's also going to improve outcome for people, for black people. And most importantly, seeing it used in a real-life scenario in hospitals is going to be amazing. And also, one thing I would say is that the concept behind this is to educate people in preparation for their service on the field, because it would look so maybe unprofessional, right, to be fiddling with phones while talking to a patient, you know. But the idea of this is that we need to educate patients, educate people around certain conditions. So while they go in the field to deliver health services, they are fully aware and prepared for certain conditions and know what it represents. So the whole concept is education and also help medical students be better doctors.
All right, Ibe. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Chidi Ebere Ibe in Nigeria. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
Most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In many countries around the world, there are sets of laws protecting the rights of older people. In fact, over 14 years ago, the United Nations presented its recommendations, with one of the most noteworthy being the proposal for an international legally binding instrument dedicated to safeguarding the rights of older people. The UN Convention would ensure that age discrimination is prohibited in the law, services uphold older people's dignity, and attitudes, behaviors towards those who are aging. Just recently, Uganda's government said it's taking steps to restore values and respect for the elderly by implementing a law. That's after statistics showed a rise in neglect and abuse of older people within the community. The person behind the plans is the Minister of State for Older Persons, Gidudu Mafuabi Dominic. He emphasized the growing disconnect between the younger generation and the elderly, adding that the younger generation was largely influenced by modernity and Western culture. We are going to hear from the minister next, but first, what do young Ugandans think about the elderly in Kampala? Here are a couple of views.
If we really want to enforce values, it starts at home. It should be done in the African traditional society way. But look, these days, parents don't have time for their children. So most parents are busy at work and they come back late in the evenings. Others send their children to school, in boarding schools. So how shall we enforce the values and morality when those children don't spend time with their parents?
There are many forms of disrespect. It can be categorized into various things. But still, in different societies, consider some things disrespectful, whereas others don't. Now, like here in Uganda, the Baganda people, or is kneeled down as they are greeting elders, which is known to the same to some other cultures. So if you find an elder from such a side, if you don't greet them when you're kneeling down, they will find that disrespectful. But on the other hand, some people don't even care whether I greet them or not.
I've been speaking to the minister himself, Gidudu Mafwabi Dominic, to find out more about the government's concerns when it came to Uganda's elderly.
Well, first of all, I need to give you a little background. We, as older persons within the constitution, as a special interest group in the country, we are recognized and we are all inclusive in all aspects of the country. As much as we are the eldest, there are four interest groups, but we are the youngest, we are the latest, and there are a lot of developments we are carrying out, and we realize that there is really necessity to protect the older persons. And if you may recall, the theme this time was protection and promotion of older persons' rights, everyone's responsibility, because age is not an option. This aligns very well with our affirmative action, and we are reminding our young generation to respect the elderly, take care of them so as to get the blessings. And we cannot compromise these cherished values. They have been built in our culture, but we want them to go with modernity. So we are revising our policies so that they actually affect our day-to-day life, like in service delivery. If you go to hospital, should the elders line up? If you go to banks, should they be given priorities? If you are traveling in the bus and you see a frail old person, shouldn't it be common sense that, yes, these people should be given preferential treatment? So we want to get in the supporting law that is going to support our policies to ensure that our older persons get what they deserve.
Okay. So some of the things that you've described are quite specific, like, you know, transport, having to queue in banking halls and all of these other places. It does sound like what I would call, quote unquote, good manners that many of us growing up in many African countries were taught when we are very young. Have those things really gone away, or why do you feel the need to put it down in writing as part of the country's law?
You see, now children stay less with the parents. So that old culture where the influence of the parents is the dominant is waning off, and modernity has come in, technology has come in. Young people move much faster and so on, and in most cases they are in boarding schools. So when we reflect and see what is happening in the countryside, it's important that we bring in policies where policies will just work without supporting law. We leave it there. For instance, like now, we're having a lot of cases regarding land abuse, sexual abuse, gender violence. So you may find it's necessary to have the supporting law so that whoever is concerned will know, yes, if I don't do this, this will happen.
So let me ask you, because you've talked about our wide-ranging issues, how far does this law go? What are the other things that this bill is looking at?
It's a wide range, but we can't do omnibus. We shall introduce this, see how it works, and then see how we can change here and there. So it's a gradual process, but we want to make a start, and everybody should know that, yes, we care.
Minister, I'm just curious how you might legislate, for example, a young person not standing up or letting an elder person through in a queue or stand up when they walk in and there's nowhere for them to sit. How do you enforce something like that?
We are creating norms. Some of them will be legislated. For instance, like those to do with land. If you are my son, it doesn't automatically mean that the land I have is yours. So we say, no, if you take your father's land without his consent, it's criminal. We shall introduce these things gradually and where we think it's necessary. We want it to be natural.
I understand, Minister. I mean, if it comes to transfer of property, that is quite straightforward into what a law can do about that. Part of this that I was trying to understand was the point that you started on, that ensuring that younger people are respecting their elders, which you felt those values are sort of fading away. How do you legislate that?
You see, there are those things that may not be in black and white, but within the community, it should be understood that, yes, what you are doing is not respect. We may not arrest you, but the leaders will caution you. They say, no, for us, the agreed way of life is this, so that if you abuse, it's criminal. There will be a supporting law. But a thing like you go to the bank and the old person is in a queue, you don't do anything. If we are talking about it on radio, in churches and so on, it will be imbibed in your head that, no, if an old person comes, I must give way. It's like a law. So it's a mixture. Some will be legislated, others will be common sense.
So, Minister, start by telling me what were the, you know, the cultural norms regarding taking care for older persons in Uganda and whether that has changed and why is it changing?
When I was young, we never went to boarding schools. We stayed home. We provided the labor. Every morning I'd wake up, take the cows, fetch water, clean the compound. But this has changed. The children go to boarding schools. The parents are allowed. So they need sustainable income for them to replace these services they used to get from their children. So you can see that there is more demand on empowering these various categories of people in the country so that they are self-sustaining.
Right. Minister, I need us to close this interview, but in very few words then, is it in law who is an older person in Uganda and who is a young person? How does the law define that?
An old person is someone who is 60 years and above. Then a young person is someone who goes up to 31 years. The law is clear on that.
Thanks very much to Gidudu Mafwabi Dominic, Uganda's Minister of State for Older Persons. Lots to think about there. I wonder whether you agree with the minister. It got me thinking about how attitudes towards the elderly are changing in many countries, not only in Africa, but around the world. And that's Focus on Africa today. It was produced by Rob Wilson, Yvette Twagira Maria, and Victor Silva in London. The senior journalist in charge was Carney Sharp, and Nick Randell was a technical producer. Our editors are Andrew Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. Goodbye for now.
What are people around the world doing to help tackle the climate emergency?
Climate shocks that we are experiencing.
Droughts, floods, decimated agriculture and so on.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service looks for answers to those challenges posed by climate change.
How can we solve this?
It's all being discussed.
We only hear the bad stuff in the news, don't we? And there's loads of quiet progress.
Reasons to be hopeful.
Solutions exist. We just need to be able to implement them at scale.
The Climate Question. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.